குட் மார்னிங் அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் வணக்கம். இன்றைய வெப் மீட்டிங் லைஃப் டிவைன் நிகழ்ச்சி நடக்க இருக்கிறது. டுடேஸ் டாபிக் இஸ் பவுண்டரிஸ் ஆஃப் தி இக்னரன்ஸ். ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
குட் மார்னிங். Supposing I ask you where you live, what will you tell me? What will you say? Huh? Tell me. Where are you? Chennai. Is it enough? Tinagar. Is it enough? Normally, if we ask a friend where you live, I'll say in Tinagar, or if I know Tinagar, you'll tell me the street. We're doing a lot of posting overseas with our journal and everything. Occasionally, we get an envelope back, and I say, you have not even given the country. You have given a town without even telling them the country. Sometimes, occasionally, rarely, they have given the street without giving the town. But if we really want to give a complete address, total address, that could be followed anywhere, anytime, what would we say? What's our address? Okay, we're all from Chennai. Chennai is in India. India is on Earth, which is the third planet from the sun. This sun, which we call sun, it's only a star. This star is located in the Milky Way galaxy. Any idea how many suns there are in the Milky Way galaxy? Huh? In the Milky Way galaxy, there are millions of stars, huh? Huh? That's the assumption, huh? Actually, there's not millions of stars. There's billions of stars. In the Milky Way, the closest count, I don't know how accurately they have done it, is 300 billion stars in the Milky Way. How many that comes in crores, I can't calculate that. That's about, I can't calculate crores. But the Milky Way is not our full address, because the Milky Way is only one galaxy in the universe. Any idea how many galaxies there are in the universe? By closest count, there are about 100 billion galaxies, and our galaxy has 300 billion stars in it. Why is that important? All of this is part of our universe. Why is that important? Because according to scientists, this is the only possible universe in which human beings could live. They don't know how many universes there are or whether there are other universes. We have no way of knowing. But maybe there are a billion universes, for all we know. But the point is, there is something so unique about our universe that if this universe were even slightly different than the way it is, there could be no life anywhere in the universe. That makes us very special. But that also tells us something else. This whole universe has been created for us so that we could exist. We think we are concerned about the traffic or the roads and the water supply in Tinaga, or the government of Tamil Nadu and the policies and tax rates. Somebody may be concerned about global warming or the global economy, but actually the thing that determines whether we can be here today living and breathing and thinking is something that's been fixed for the whole universe with the billions and trillions of stars. Who fixed it? Who made it that way? Who made the universe this way so that out of the 3 billion or 300 billion galaxies and the hundreds of billions of stars in the galaxy, we could live on Earth? Something has made it that way. We say it's the divine. Why is that important to us? Because we live in our tiny little world in Tinaga or West Mombalam. And we think of that as our universe. We think of that as our world, our family, and all. But if we really want to know our true context, it's greater than the universe. This chapter he calls the boundaries of the ignorance. And the truth of the matter is that we know just about as much about ourselves as we do about our address in the cosmos. Because if the cosmos is 100 billion times or millions and billions of times bigger than where we are, our true self, our true being, is not just in quantity, but in every sense, billions or trillions or unmeasurably greater than what we think of ourselves. Our true self, if our home is so much greater, our being is so much greater, and yet we live in a tiny block, in a tiny compound somewhere in Tinaga or West Mombalam or Pondicherry or wherever it is, and we call that home. We think that's ours. So this chapter, he tries to tell us not where we live, but who we are. And not just in the minute detail of how many rooms are there in our flat or our house or what's on the corner and who lives next door, but what are the boundaries of our being, the full boundaries of our being. That's the boundaries of our ignorance, because we think of ourselves, usually we think of ourselves, I'm here, I'm now, I'm sitting in the center, I'm in this chair, you're there. I am this, about this big. But that's not the truth of our being. And meaning, that's not the truth of our ignorance. Who is Elizabeth Bennett? What does she know of herself? If you ask Elizabeth Bennett, she'll say, I'm the 21-year-old daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Bennett. We're living in Meriden. We live at Longbourn. I have 4 sisters. The Gardners are my aunt and uncle. I have friends like Charlotte. What does she know of herself? What does she know of her being? What does she know of her potential? What does she know of her past or of her future? What does she know of her inheritance, of who she really is. In the story, she discovers that she's her mother's daughter. Probably something she was trying to forget for the last 5 or 7 years, and say, fortunately, I'm not like my mother. But she discovers in the story she is her mother's daughter. What does she know of her future? When Jane gets married, she says, you have to marry well, she tells to Jane, when Bingley shows interest in her, because I probably may never get married at all. And at the end, she jokes, after Jane gets married anyway, maybe I'll marry a Collins. She has no idea that her destiny is to become the mistress of Pemberley. What does she know of her early childhood? What does she know of before her childhood? What does she know of her future lives and destiny? And what does she know of the Creator of whom she is a part? At least in this case, we know something of that Creator. If we don't know our Creator, we know her Creator. Her Creator is Jane Austen. Can she ever imagine that she's a tiny little particle in a story? Not her only story. She's one of so many characters in the story who are creations and projections of Jane Austen's personality, her creative imagination. And as there may be other universes, there are other stories that Jane Austen has written in which she doesn't exist at all, but so many other people exist, and they are all parts and expressions of Jane Austen's creative consciousness. And yet all the stories, Jane didn't write that many, but Trollope wrote about 50, 60. Shakespeare wrote 37 plays. All the stories don't tell us who Jane Austen is. They're only expressions of Jane Austen. Jane Austen is something beyond all her stories. And who was Jane Austen in her past life and in her future life? We don't know at all. We know about as much about ourselves as Elizabeth Bennet really knows about herself. Maybe less. These are the boundaries of our ignorance. We know, he's been telling us very politely but very insistently, that we're ignorant. Not because we didn't get 100% in all our exams, not because we don't know everything that other people know around us, not because we can't use the latest technology, or we don't know the geography of the world, or we don't remember everybody's name who we've met in the past, or anything like that. He's been telling us in a much more fundamental way that the nature of the human consciousness is ignorance. By very definition, we are ignorant. And he's been systematically pointing out to us, very politely, you don't know this, you don't know that, we don't know this, we don't know what's going on there, we don't know what happened before, we don't know what's going to happen the next minute. In this chapter, he tries to tell us systematically, what are the fundamental limitations of our knowledge, and what will we have to do? What do we have to change if we really want to have the knowledge that he says is offered to us, that he offers us, that is our destiny as spiritual beings to acquire? We don't know our potentials. We don't know our capacities. We don't know what we're going to achieve even a year or two from now. Probably for most of us, if we look back 10, 20 years and reflect on what we have done today, we never would have thought that that was going to happen to us. Then what's going to happen next year or 5 years from now or day after tomorrow? We don't know. These are boundaries of our ignorance. We're not only ignorant, We each think we're alone. Okay, we have friends, we have relatives, we have children, we have parents, we have neighbors and all. But fundamentally, when everything comes back to everything, I have to rely on myself. I'm responsible for myself. We don't realize the truth, the spiritual truth, that everybody else we know is part of ourselves. It's only an idea. We don't know ourselves in space and time. Darcy doesn't understand why wherever he goes, Wickham keeps coming back in the picture. He doesn't get the connection. He goes to visit his sister at the seaside, and he sees Wickham standing next to her. He's shocked. And he gets more shocked when he finds out that they were just planning to elope. He thinks he settled with Wickham finally and got rid of him. He comes to Meryton. He meets Elizabeth. He's just getting somewhat interested in her. And the next day he comes into Meryton and he sees Wickham there, of all people, talking to her. What is he doing here? How does he come there? Why is he talking to the one person in the world that I'm interested in? He goes away from Meryton, forgets Wickham, forgets Lizzie. He comes to Pemberley and finds Lizzie standing on the front lawn, walking down the path. 6 months later. And when he goes a couple of days later to call on her at the inn, he finds her crying. And when he says, "What's wrong? What can I do? What's the problem?" the first word out of her mouth is Wickham. What does this man keep coming into his existence? What does he have to do with me, with him? We don't understand our relationships in space. We don't understand our relationships in time. We live in the moment. We see something happening in the moment. We sense it. We feel it. We hear it. We think about it. And then it's gone. What was that last moment? Where did it go? We don't know what's going to come the next moment. We just live at one moment, like in a movie where we see it going. The moment the scene is gone, you can't go back. You can't go back even to just what was there a second. We don't know what's coming 1 second later. We are in a movement in time. We're at a location in space. We're ignorant of our opportunities. When Darcy comes to the dance and Bingley says, "Why don't you dance with Elizabeth Bennet? She's also very pretty." He says, "Tolerable." He's faced with, confronted, offered the greatest opportunity of his life. Not according to us. Later on, according to his own conclusion, "This is the greatest opportunity that's ever come to me, and I called her tolerable, turned away, and refused, and caused myself so many problems." And Elizabeth's response to him was no more intelligent, no more informed. She had an instinctive dislike for Lynn. When Lizzie gets news that they have eloped, when she confesses to Darcy the catastrophe that's happened, when he takes leave of her, she's absolutely positive, "I will never see him again. He's trying to get away from me. He's trying to run away as fast and as far as he can. It's over. Finished." She's totally ignorant of what's going to come, of what the future potential is. We're ignorant of our troubles, too. Of the problems we invite. Mr. Bennet insists on sending Lydia to Brighton, having no idea what the tragedy is he's calling down on his own head. Darcy interferes with Bingley's marriage and is proud of his rationality. He tells Bingley, "No, you see, for your station in life, you cannot afford to relate to people with such inferior connections." He's very proud of how impersonal and selfless he is and how rational he is in his arguments. he can never imagine if it's inappropriate for Bingley to marry a Jain, how much more inappropriate is for Darcy to marry Jane's sister. He creates his own problem and has to go back and try to undo it later. All of these things are expressions of the fact that we live in the ignorance bounded on all sides by that ignorance. And of course, for us, we don't blame Darcy and Elizabeth for their ignorance. This is only a story. Nobody in the story ever mentions God. Nobody ever thinks of God. Even the clergyman who's supposed to be dedicating his life to God never thinks of God. What about, where does the divine come into the story? Where does Mother come in to their lives? They don't know themselves. They don't know their past. They don't know their future. They have no conception. The divine doesn't come into things at all. Similarly, how much do we really know about Mother? How much do we know about what Mother's offering us, where Mother is in our life, what Mother wants to be in our life, what Mother wants to offer us? What is our true relationship with Mother? Sri Aurobindo says, to our utter bewilderment, why do you want to worship God? Your destiny is to become God. Doesn't make any sense to us. We're very happy that there's a mother there and she wants to take care of us. Where's the question of becoming? We're not so ambitious that we think of becoming the divine. But he says it's not a question of ambition. It's a question of destiny. It's a question of inevitability. Because the truth of the matter is we are the divine. So certainly we have a lot to learn. If you think about the story, it's easier to think about the story than our own lives because we can laugh at the characters and we know what's going to happen and all. We see that every character is ignorant about just about everything. It's a simple generalization. What do they know? They know very little. They know very little of who they are or what's going to happen to them or who the people around them are. Elizabeth and Darcy don't know their own character. We have some sense of their character. Elizabeth, only after she reads Darcy's letter at Hunsford, she says, I never knew myself till now. She didn't know herself, and she certainly doesn't know Darcy. What does she know of Wickham? She says, any man who's this handsome must be good. She's judging his character by his appearance. What does she know of him? What does she know of Darcy when he's staring at her and she says, oh, that man is trying to intimidate me, when actually he's falling in love with her? She doesn't know. What does she know of Darcy's past and Wickham's past? She has believed some tale, some story that Wickham has told her that has no reality to it. What does she think of her future? She has no conception of what's coming for her. She never imagined she could be mistress of Pemberley. Until she sees Pemberley, she never imagines there could be anything so marvelous and wonderful as Pemberley. What does she know about the life of England at that time? There's the French Revolution going on across the Channel, and it's changing the whole society. And she's not thinking of French Revolution. She's not thinking of the classes coming together. She's not thinking of the fact that her mother already rose from the middle class to marry a wealthy gentleman. She's not thinking of how the society is going to change in future. She's lost in the moment, lost in her preferences. She's thinking about the ball. She's thinking about the dress she's going to wear. She's thinking about the officers that have come. She's thinking about who's going to marry Jane. She's preoccupied in the tiny little things. Like them, we live on the surface. We live on the surface. He calls it a bubble. We live in a tiny bubble on the surface of the ocean, which is infinitely great. And that ocean is ourselves, our true self. It's not that we don't know the ocean, we don't know the universe, we don't know the divine. We don't know ourselves. Our own experience of ourselves is a tiny little bubble of our real being, of our real experience. We are only conscious of a tiny little bit of our own existence. Our waking, what we call our waking consciousness, we're only conscious of a little bit of what's going on around us. When I talk to you, I may not be conscious of the fact that I'm moving my hands or I'm moving my feet. There'll be sounds going on which I'm ignoring. There'll be movements going on which I don't even register because I'm thinking of what I'm doing. I'm thinking of this. There are so much going on. There'll be sounds coming from outside. We register only a tiny portion. We concentrate only on a tiny portion of what's going on around us. Imagine if now everybody's sitting quietly and we're all trying to concentrate. Imagine you're in the bazaar. How much do you observe? After you've gone back from the bazaar, how many people can you describe who you saw and passed? What did they look like? What were they wearing? Which direction were they going? How old were they? Were they smiling or crying? It's all there in front of us, but we don't even register it, even though it's there for us to see. And this is only the most superficial external observation of our senses. But that's not the limit of our consciousness or our being. We filter out things. We select a tiny portion. If I ask you what you did yesterday, you might describe to me in 3 sentences or 3 minutes, or if you had a really very unusual day with something very special, you might take 30 minutes to narrate a very fascinating incident or a frustrating experience that you had at that time. But does that really communicate what your day was like? All the things you did, all the moves you had, all the feelings you had, all the thoughts you had, all the people you came in contact with, all the things, sights that came visually before your eyes? We are conscious and register only a tiny portion of our experience. The rest we filter out. When it comes to the past, how much of our past do we really remember? Sometimes if somebody asks me, I think, what did I do yesterday? What happened yesterday? That's yesterday. What about the days before yesterday and the years before this year and the months and weeks and so forth and so on? How much have we lost? How much have we really kept track of? If I ask you about your future, how much have you thought about your future? What you're going to do, what's going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, next decade? It's a mystery to us. It's a blank to us. We are having so much of experience all the time. So Appa has taken one simple story, 300 pages, we watch it as a movie in 5 hours. And for the last 8 years, he's been showing how much we have missed in that simple story that's a 5-hour thing to watch. Maybe it takes 50 hours to read. What about our own life experience? How much experience is going on around us? We're hearing from other devotees their experiences. How much have we learned from our own experience in the past? How much have we learned from the experience of devotees? How much have we learn from what Appa has written about his experience and others in the books, we get just a tiny little portion of the knowledge that's offered to us. We really are just a bubble on the surface. The greatest part of our life, our experience, and ourself, we're not aware of. He says he wants to give us an overview of the real boundaries of our ignorance, and he says to do that, we have to understand that our ignorance is sevenfold. We are not just ignorant. We are ignorant in at least seven different ways, uniquely different ways. The first of these ways he calls the constitutional ignorance. The constitutional ignorance is we think of ourselves as a mental, vital, physical being. If we think of ourselves, either I tell you, this is me. If somebody calls, who's Gary? I raise my hand. I'm my body. This is my body. I'm here, you're there. Other people are elsewhere. If you want to know more about me, I'll tell you about socially who I am, where I'm from, where my family is, who my friends are, what work I do. I can describe myself vitally in terms of my occupation, or we can talk about how much wealth a person has, how much power they have, how much influence they have, how much popularity they have. We define ourselves socially. Or we can define ourselves mentally. This is what I believe. This is what I think. These are my ideas. These are my opinions. And if you ask anybody to tell about themselves, I think you can be pretty sure that what they're going to tell us is either they're going to tell you how old they are, which is about their body, when it was born, not how old your soul is. They're going to tell you where maybe you were born, how tall, how much I weigh, what is the color of my hair or eyes or skin or whatever it is. I'm going to talk about my family and my social relationships and what I have done and what is my education and where I have lived and where I have worked. It's all social. What I have accomplished, what we have accomplished socially. I married this person. I am from this family or this community. Or this is what I think. These are my aspirations. These are my goals. These are my plans. And I don't think we could have tried it as an exercise sometime. If you see anybody writing their life story, whether in one page or in a whole book, I don't think you'll find anything that goes beyond a description of our physical, vital, social, and mental personality. And it gets more complex than that, because between the physical, vital, and mental personality, we are not one person. We are not really one person. We are all like Darcy when he goes to propose to Lizzie. His heart says, I want you, I want to marry you. His mind says, I'm a fool for proposing to you. I think I'm one person. I'm trying to behave as if I'm one simple, rational person. But my heart and my mind are going in different directions. And we do that in all different ways. We read Appa's book and he tells us something about mother and he says, I know mother can solve this problem. I know I shouldn't do this thing. I should do that thing. And my mind is fully convinced. And then I go and do the opposite. So I know if I get annoyed, if this person annoys me and I react, I'm only going to make it worse. And my mind is very clear. If I react to this person who's trying to annoy me, trying to provoke me, I'm only going to give them energy, it's going to get worse. If I don't react, if I can be calm, indifferent, neutral, equal, cheerful, I can be free. I know that, but I still react. My vital doesn't accept what my... I know so many times when mother, just calling mother, relying on mother, I've been cured of an illness, and so many people have been cured of serious illnesses. But the next time I get a headache or a pain or a stomach ache, I'm saying, where's the medicine? My mind believes, maybe, or my heart believes, but what does my body believe? And the scientists have studied and showed you, you simply give anything to the body, if the mind believes that it's good, it'll work. In fact, now they're doing studies where they're telling the person, I'm going to give you this medicine to cure you, but it's really not a medicine, it's only a placebo. And they still get improved, even when they know it's not a medicine. We live in the constitutional ignorance means we don't know who we are. We think we are the physical body. I'm here, you're there. I'm this many years old. We think we are defined in terms of our social accomplishments, our family background. It's all, say, Lizzie thinks she knows Wickham because he grew up at Pemberley. He's the godson of Mr. Darcy. What did he know? What did she really know of him? And sometimes we define ourselves by our thoughts, by our convictions. I'm a mother's devotee. I have decided I'm a mother's devotee. After all, I go to the center. I have mother's photo. I read the her books or Appa's books, I call myself, yes, I believe in mother. But how much does my body believe in mother? How much are my vital attitudes the way mother would appreciate them? In the book, The Mother, Sri Aurobindo has listed some 27 beautiful characteristics, which are characteristics of our constitutional ignorance. And he says, if you really want to relate to mother, first thing we have to do is we have to give up these 27 characteristics. He actually said, if you really want to be human, we shouldn't have these. Mother says, as long as we have fear, we're not human. Animals have fear. So this is part of our constitutional ignorance. Stubbornness. As long as we're stubborn, we're in the constitutional ignorance. It's a characteristic of the body. The body doesn't like to move. It doesn't like to change. Laziness. Mr. Bennett undid his whole family simply because he was lazy. He wanted peace and quiet. Let her go to Brighton and leave me alone. At least for 3 months, peace and quiet. Refusal to change. Carolyn's jealousy. The joy that Mrs. Bennett takes in dominating over Lady Lucas, triumphing over Lady Lucas. Competition, envy, doubt. He says, if we have doubt, we're living in the constitutional ignorance. Our whole life is filled with doubts. Doubts, confusions, disbeliefs. These are the characteristics of our mental, vital, physical personality. And he says if we want to come out of the constitutional ignorance, he's not asking any great yogic feat from us. He's very reasonable. He says simply the first thing you should do is become rational. Rational. Appa says perhaps he's never met a rational person. Maybe there is no rational person. Rational person is, means we should be able to think and act and feel according to our highest understanding. When we look around at the society, what do we see? The society worships, admires, and appreciates all wrong things. All wrong things. Yet, how pleased we are when the society appreciates us. The society admires the corrupt politician, the rich man who has cheated everybody, the tyrant, the strong man who has dominated, the liar. Yet, when the society offers to give recognition to us, it may be our neighbor, it may be our family, how sweet it is, how nice it is to be appreciated, how much we want their acceptance and appreciation. We know they're wrong. Say, Lizzie thinks Wickham's a good person, but everybody would like to have Lizzie's appreciation. She's important. What is the value of her appreciation? Bingley will do anything to get the appreciation of Darcy. But what is the value of Darcy's appreciation? The direct advice he gives Bingley is wrong. He's going to ask him to change it. He's going to reverse it. But Bingley lives only for Darcy's appreciation. He has no other standard. For him, Darcy's the law. If Darcy appreciates, he's a success. It's irrational, no? Why, when Darcy comes and says, say, I changed my mind, I think you can marry, why don't you marry Jane? Bingley doesn't say, what made you change your mind? Darcy gives a very sheepish look, says, I want to marry Elizabeth. Bingley never asked that question. He doesn't want to know why he changed his mind. He doesn't want to question Darcy's authority. He simply wants Darcy's opinion. After Darcy has come and encouraged him to marry Jane, and then Darcy, he finds out a few days later, Darcy's very secretive. Until Lizzie accepts him, Darcy doesn't mention anything about Lizzie to Bingley. Afterwards, Bingley never comes to him and says, how is it, Darcy? You told me not to marry Jane because she has relatives in Cheapside, and now you want to marry Elizabeth? How is it? How could you do that? How could you be so wrong? He never questions. When Bingley disappears the day after the Netherfield ball and goes to London and doesn't come back to Jane for a year, I always wonder, how is it this girl never asked him, what happened? Where did you go? Why did you disappear? She never questions anything. She wants his acceptance. She wants to be his wife. She values his opinion. He told her. He told them all, I'm a person who can change his mind in 1 minute and go. And then he did it the next day and proved it was true. But his opinion is valuable to her. Is it rational? Is it rational when we know that the politician, I've seen very highly distinguished people who have been going around the world and receiving international awards. And one of them told me one day, I have to go now because I'm going to have breakfast with MGR. And he has a big, proud smile on his face. Say, I know, and he knows very well, that MGR had 30,000 files piled up in the halls of his home. Files for work to be done in Tamil Nadu, which are not being done because the people refuse to pay him the money that he's asking for. At that time, they used to ask only for lakhs. Now they ask for crores. Now they have warehouses for all the files. I said, he's a man who has met presidents. He testified before parliaments. He's been at the UN. He's been recognized in all the great international forum. How can he be so proud of going and having breakfast with NGR? The man is, if he's not a scoundrel, anyway, he's a movie star. And then we have people like NPR and NGR, same thing. They're worshipped by people because in a movie they have played a divine character. So what is the value of being worshipped by the society or appreciated by the society or getting the permission of Darcy or the approval of Collins or of Lady Catherine? Is it really worth having? But this is what we crave. Where are we living? What is it we're seeking? What are our values? But the truth of the matter is, even when we pray to Mother and think of ourselves as Mother devotees and say, Mother, I will do anything for you, what I really mean is, society should bless me, society should approve of me, everybody should admire me and wish they were me, and say I'm a success and I'm a good person and I'm a devotee and so many things like that. We live in the most superficial part of a vital consciousness which is not even mental. If we were to be mental, we would look back at all these things and feel how foolish we were all the time. Some 25 years ago, I was giving a presentation in an international conference, and I was very foolishly proud of my presentation. I said, I know I'm really going to say something very original here, and I wanted some appreciation from those who were there. And just before my presentation, there was another presentation by an economist lady from World Bank, and I honestly felt she had spent some $25,000 on her research. We paid for it. And she didn't say anything of any use in that presentation. And the man in the meeting who I most wanted to appreciate me appreciated her and said this was magnificent. And I told myself, if he thinks this is magnificent, what is the value of his appreciation for me? But I still want it. Even if it's silly, after all, he said it. I can tell other people, that man appreciated me. We are not rational. To be rational means, what does it mean? It means the physical and the vital should subordinate themselves to our mental understanding. But what's the truth? Appa coined this phrase. I don't think I've read it in Sri Aurobindo, but he said it to me 30 years ago, 30, 40 years ago. He said, your mind is dominated by the vital. Sounded like a very serious disease to have a mind dominated by the vital. I didn't understand at that time. That's almost the definition of the human mind. The human mind is dominated by the vital. It does everything according to what the vital wants. Our rationality is, I can explain my point of view. I can explain how I'm right and everybody else is wrong. I can always argue in favor of what my vital wants. Mr. Bennett does it beautifully. When she comes and tells him, she says, don't send Lydia to Brighton. He gives all the reasons why he should send, who's going to pay attention to a girl? She has no money. She's a silly little girl. Anyway, I'll get no peace and quiet. He thinks he's being rational. And then, other people will get a wrong idea. She says, oh, have some of your lovers been chased away? Don't worry, you'll get plenty more. It's not rationality, no? And Mr. Bennett, I think you'll agree, is the most sensible person in the whole story. If there's anybody with a mind there, with some intelligence, who laughs, he laughs at Collins, no? He laughs at Lady Catherine. He's, in himself, he's making fun of everybody who's silly and irrational and superstitious. But how is he any different? His mind is simply there to justify his feelings, his preferences, his own physical inclinations. So if we want to come out of the constitutional ignorance, the first thing we have to do is we have to free our mind from domination by what we want. I would say there's nothing wrong with saying that. I would say what Darcy did was, instead of acting in a very selfish, boorish, arrogant, and offensive way, Darcy, I think, is a good example of the mind dominated by the vital. When Bingley says, why don't you dance with her? He's only thinking of her connections. Oh, she's got relatives in Cheapside. Oh, she's living in Meryton. Oh, she's got a mother like that. What does that have to do with her? He's judging her, not mentally, not rationally. Later on, he begins to appreciate, oh, she's a girl who's so selfless. She's thinking only of her sister. When I want to propose to her, she's rejecting me in spite of all my money. She's rejecting me because she thinks I'm not a good person, because she believed. He begins to think rationally about her. I've never met a person like this. No. But I would say, nothing wrong with calling it rational, because for him, to go to London and save Lydia, he has to give up his vital prejudice against Lydia, against Wickham. He has to pay. How can I pay Wickham? How can he convince himself? The vital can never agree to pay Wickham a penny. He wants to kill. The vital wants to kill Wickham. He convinces himself, well, if that's what I have to do, it's worth doing. Even if I'm making Wickham my brother-in-law, from a higher point of view, maybe I'm not that much better than he is. Maybe I'm no better than he is. I may be complaining that Mrs. Bennett is being my mother-in-law, but actually my own aunt is no better than Mrs. Bennett. In that sense, you can say, he becomes objective. He becomes impartial. He gives up the social values and sees her value as a human being. He's not made a mistake in doing this. He has done the very right thing for him. There's nobody in the world, maybe, at least in this story, who can make Darcy as happy and help him be as good as she can. She's got the courage, she's got the strength, she's got the clarity of mind, she's got the cheerfulness to counter for his, what we'd call a dour, sour kind of personality. She's the very right choice for him, and he decides, I'm willing to do anything in order to get her. You can say he becomes rational in that measure. Where he really shows his rationality is when he proposes to her the second time, and she starts talking about the first proposal and how embarrassed she is. He said, don't talk about, after all, what did you tell me that wasn't true? That's rationality. The points in the story, there are three points in the story where rationality is exhibited. One is after the elopement, when Mr. Bennett comes back and admits to Lizzie, you see, I should have listened to you. What you said was true. I was wrong. I should suffer for it. I have created this problem for myself. That's rationality. When Lizzie reads Darcy's letter at Hunsford, and she recognizes, in spite of the fact that she hates him, in spite of the fact that everything he writes is an abomination to her, she comes to the conclusion, yes, I am like that. I have been acting absurdly. In the book, it comes out very clearly because Jane Austen writes, she reflected back on what she knew about Wickham, and she realized, I don't know anything about him. She even reflects, I didn't want to know anything about him. I only wanted to appreciate him. Her analysis of herself when she says, I never knew myself till now, she recognized that it's not Darcy who will ruin things for Jane. It was her own family. At least she sees her mother's role and Lydia's role and her father's role. It doesn't specifically come out, but she's conscious it's her own irrationality. It was her own character that created this. And Darcy, when he says at the end, after all, what did you tell me that wasn't true? He called her selfish, he called her arrogant, he called her proud, he called her mean, called him mean, and he says, what did you tell me that wasn't true? That's not only rationality, that's sincerity. That's Mother's definition of sincerity. Mother's definition of sincerity is that each of our parts of being acts according to its rightful place. It's not for the body to tell the mind. It's not for the vital to tell the mind what's true. It's for the mind to tell the vital what's true, and it's for the vital to accept the truth of it and decide to act accordingly, to give its energy and enthusiasm for what's true. If we read something that Appa says, that we should accept that the other person is totally right and feel very sorry and apologize to them, mind may say, yes, yes, of course I should take the other person's point of view, but I don't like the other person's point of view. If I take the other person's point of view, I'll be doing exactly what I don't want to do. Then how can I do that? The vital will protest. Even if the vital accepts, the body will refuse to act. I'll do it tomorrow. And then I'd forget it completely. So if we're to be sincere in the constitution of our being, the body should be activated by the energy of the vital, and the vital should be directed by the rational, right thought and knowledge of the mind. But he says, the mind is ignorant. So what are we going to get if the body, vital and body, are following an ignorant mind, which doesn't know anything? He says, the truth is, we must know that the physical, vital, and mental are all projections of our real being, which is the psychic being. And it's that should be the leader. Only when we know mind is not the boss, mind is foolish, ignorant, vital is perverse, prejudiced, subjective, desire-ridden, body is dull, unconscious, inert, and lazy. Only when they all follow the psychic, then they can be integrated and we can overcome the constitutional ignorance. But as a first step, if we can become rational, which means we shouldn't be superstitious. It's very difficult not to be superstitious. That person has a new car, a new sari, a new job, a new this, a new that, more money in the bank account. More money means they're better, right? That's a rich man. That means he's important, right? Lady Catherine's very important. She's got a title. She's a lady. She's got a huge house. She's got chimneys. Don't forget the chimneys and the staircases and how many windows are there. Collins has counted them all for us. We judge her character by her chimneys and her staircases and her... We shouldn't be superstitious. This is the constitutional ignorance. Everything should be in its place. Really, everything should defer to the psychic. Problem is, where is the psychic and where does the psychic come into anything here? It's only a word for us because we're living on the surface. The psychic doesn't come to the surface. The psychic is not going to whisper what we should do and what we should feel and all that. And when suddenly I feel The Bible says, my psychic says this. The Bible, according to the Bible, that everything I want to do, my psychic says is I should do. According to my mind, anything I want or believe, my psychic says is true. That's not the psychic. That's our superstition and imagination on the surface. This is the constitutional ignorance because we live, he says, in the plane of matter. We actually think of ourselves as physical people. When I say, who is Sundari or Vijaya or anyone else, well, that's me. We think, we point to the body. We think this is us because we live in the physical plane. We don't realize we're spiritual beings. We don't even think of ourselves as mental beings. We don't think of ourselves as universal beings. That's going beyond to the rest of the chapter. We think of ourselves, I am here now. What can I do? I'm all alone. I'm only one person. All of these ways we have of thinking of ourselves physically, and we rely on this mentality which is dominated by our vitality. If we could just clear the air and just tell them to be quiet for a little and just think rationally, very difficult to do. We can do it a little bit about the story, even if we can't do it about ourselves. So much would be clear. The constitutional ignorance would begin to clear up, but then we would understand the only answer for us is, I've got to get off the surface. Because on the surface, there's only ignorance. Because by definition, I think I'm separate and different from everybody else. So I've got to get off the surface. So that takes us to the second of the seven ignorances, which he calls the psychological ignorance. What is the psychological ignorance? It's essentially, I think I am my physical, vital, mental being. I don't know the real boundaries of my being. What are the boundaries of your being? He says our being is got four, we live in four spheres. And the smallest, tiniest, least significant of those four is the one we call home. It's the surface. Beneath the surface, there's a huge subconscious or inconscient being from which we have evolved, of which we're totally unaware. But it's us. So our body, now that we're talking and thinking about these things, we're not worried about, is my heart beating, is my breathing correct, is my blood pressure and temperature being maintained? It's all happening subconsciously. The body is digesting the food, breathing, circulating the blood. We're not focusing on that. Even if we want to, we don't know how to do it. The base of our being, the whole living being of which we are come up to, we're now, we've got our head 1 inch above the surface of the water. The plant is down below, is not conscious. We have one little thin, we're up above the surface of the water and we're looking around and we think we are conscious. But 99% of our being is below the surface. It's unconscious. I like that person. Why? I don't know. I don't like that person. Why? I don't know. Lizzie doesn't know why she likes Wickham. She says he's a good man. She doesn't say, I'm just like my mother. I'm attracted to a red coat, and I inherited that from my mother. She doesn't like Darcy. She doesn't know why. Why she? Later she reflects, he's so proud. I want to be proud, and he offends my pride. Therefore, I don't like him. That she figures out only later. Darcy, never occurs to Darcy that she may not like him or want to marry him. We just are on the surface. We don't know what's going on beneath. Appa says when Darcy called her tolerable, one of the mysteries of the story is, why did he say it so loudly? So Darcy doesn't seem to be a mean person. He may be boorish and proud and arrogant and all, but he's not mean. He doesn't do anything in the story to be mean. Of course, he does crack one joke about Mrs. Bennett's wit that is a little mean, but it's almost pardonable she's so foolish. But why, when in the first dance, when he's talking to Bingley, why does he call Lizzie tolerable in such a loud voice that she hears him? I could never explain it to myself. It was very puzzling. I can understand he thinks it foolishly. Appa has given the explanation. He's proposing to her. That is, consciously, everything she represents is objectionable to him. But subconsciously, he already recognizes that this is the person. He creates a relationship with her. He doesn't know it on the surface. It's below the surface. Lizzie goes to Netherfield to take care of Jane. Nobody asked her to go to Netherfield. Her parents don't want her to go. Darcy and Carolyn think it's an intrusion and very odd that she should go and she should run across the fields in the mud and everything. Appa says she goes there to get Darcy. It's not Jane she's worried about. If Jane's going to marry Bingley, I should marry somebody more than that. She's not aware of it. She's thinking of poor Jane needs companionship. She goes there to evoke a response from Darcy by taunting him, teasing him, playing hard to get, and the moment she feels that he's committed, she rushes away. That's Appa's explanation. It's not going on the surface. We have a vast subconscious being. The psychologists have been trying to study it for the last 100 years, and they're getting very little, but they know. We make mistakes in the words we say. We do things. Every mistake is an expression of a subconscious intention. It comes in the movies sometimes, I don't know, some movies are there when a man or a woman is speaking affectionately to another person, she calls by the name of the other man, not this man, or the woman. Oh, you're thinking of that man. We don't know this vast subconsciousness. It's dark, it's dense. It's very difficult. It comes out in our dreams. Things that come at night, a lot of it communicates the subconscious. Anyway, it's a vast area. We're not too concerned with it now. We have to come back and clean it up later, he tells us. But that's only the second room in our being. And it's a dark place. It goes back for thousands of years. All the heritage, the worst things that we've ever read about human beings in the past is all there in that room. Mother says there's nothing in human nature we're not capable of because it's there in the subconscious. Not very flattering, but it's better to know. At least we'll be careful about opening the door if we know what's inside. It's the Pandora's box. The worst thing we can meet in another person and find abhorrent, terrible, absolutely objectionable, oh, how could anybody be so terrible as that? It's there in that room in us, too. It's there. Everything is there. At least we should know it. We need not visit there, and we need not try to clean it now. But the third room is more interesting. He called it the subliminal. The subliminal is the depths of our being. And according to that, really, the surface personality is a little bubble. Our subliminal is an ocean. He says it's like a temple built from the bottom of the ocean, and the only thing sticking out at the top is a little dome. And this is what we call ourselves. The whole temple is beneath the ocean. This is the subliminal. All that we are comes from the subliminal. He says we have an inner mental being, an inner vital being, an inner physical being from which this surface personality has been constructed. But our own being, he's not talking about somebody else's being here. Our own being, real being, is there. Mother says in the subliminal, Mother was physically quite small. Small person. She says in the subliminal, her vital being is about 12 feet tall, a giant. It's a warrior. Mother was a warrior. But you won't see it physically. She had the energy of a warrior, but you don't see it on the surface. It was there in her, the vital being. All that we are constructed on the surface is a little bit of what's there in the subliminal. All that we have become, if you have become anything that you didn't expect you could you become, it didn't come because of something came from outside. Something that was there waiting in potential has come to the surface. If you have done one thing that surprises you in your life, it's only because you have tapped the potential that was there beneath the surface and brought it to the surface. Have you ever noticed that great accomplishments come during crises and challenges are there? Say, at a point of crisis, suddenly we decide, I must take a serious effort, let me call Mother intensely, and the whole thing changes. That potential is there in the subliminal. The potential is there in the subliminal. If a person has become something great, it's not from outside it has become, it's because they have tapped a little of what's there as their subliminal potential. We see a man like Steve Jobs. He was the illegitimate child of an American and a Lebanese, American girl and a Lebanese man who gave him up at birth. He was adopted by an uneducated family. The man was a craftsman, a carpenter. He was cranky and spoiled, and he grew up to create the most successful company in the history of the world. Where did he get that potential from? It's not what he got from its education. It's not from the food he ate. That potential was there inside, and the fact that he was an illegitimate child created a pressure on him to try to prove himself, to bring out from the depth something of his potential. When Appa says 100 crores for every devotee, he's only saying 100 to be reasonable about it, because he sees that potential is there in the being of every devotee. It's not out there. It's there as potential. He says any devotee can rise to the top of the world in the field of their choice, whatever that choice may be. Because so much of potential is there. We only have to bring it to the surface, and that's what Mother wants to do, is to bring it to the surface. Say, if somebody doesn't know anything about technology, say it's 100 years ago or 150 years ago, Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days, 140 years ago, he said, I think I can go around the world in 80 days and come back. It looked like a fantastic, phenomenal boast. Who do you think you are? Who can travel around the world in 80 days? Ridiculous. Impossible. He was not speaking fantastically. He understood society has created the potential to travel around the world in 80 days. Nobody's done it. Today, if anybody here says, I can travel around the world in 80 hours, we can say, what took you so long? Why do you want to take 80 hours? I could do it in 60 or maybe 50. Be very tired, but anyway, what's the big deal? Because that potential has been created there for everybody. If I boast about the fact that I can speak to my family 12,000 miles away, yes, what's the big deal? We all have the phone. That's the social potential that has been created. We see the social potential. If I want to know, I know everything in the world. I just type in here and I get the information. The internet is our subliminal intelligence. Now it's existing outside, but it was always there inside. what we now get on the internet, the intuitive person could get directly without the internet. We don't need the internet to give it. So as the society has created so much capacity for each of us to travel, to get knowledge, education, wealth, whatever it may be, our own subliminal being has immense potential for knowledge, for courage, for strength, for accomplishment. When we see somebody rise up, we don't know where it comes from. It comes because one way or another, through an attitude, through a value, through something, they bring out what's there hidden inside. And what's hidden in them and hidden in all of us, it's there in all of us. Any of us can do it. If we're willing to get off of the bubble of the surface, to go in, to let the power, and in the depths of that subliminal, what do we find? We find the psychic. Our true center of being to harmonize the mental, vital, and physical is there. But the subliminal is much greater. It's universal. It goes to the boundaries. He said, if you really are in touch with your subliminal being, long before something comes to you, you will feel it coming from the outside. When somebody thinks about you anywhere in the world, or has a feeling towards you anywhere in the world, you'll feel it. Just from where you are, directly. Because our subliminal being is not limited to the body or the room or Mambalam or any place. It's universal. So, we don't need opportunities. Every opportunity that we could possibly want is there as a power and a potential. I'd say, I'm all alone, I don't know anything, I can't do anything. Then how do we get from the surface to the subliminal? He says we have to stop relying on our little surface personality and thinking this is what we are and this is our true being. Because as long as I think I don't know how to do this, I don't have the knowledge to do this, I don't have the strength to do this, you'll be right. The first thing we have to do is say, I'm not going to rely on my capacities. That's Appa's mantra, no? Don't rely on yourself, rely on Mother. How is Mother so powerful? Mother has this whole storehouse of our subliminal capacities. The moment we refuse to rely on the surface, that which is in the depth begins to come forward. So, if we want to move from the vital to the mental, we should be rational. If we want to move from the surface to the depth, we should stop relying on our capacities. And we all know how easy that is. That means don't ask anybody for anything.
Gary?
Yes, Ashok. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I thought of asking you this following question.
Please do.
See, what is it a devotee needs to precisely assess his capacity for service as well as sadhana? I find many people overrate their capacity for service as well as sadhana. Kind of exaggerate their capacities. That's what I find. One devotee friend of mine, he came and told me, I am not interested in marriage, I am dedicating myself to mother service. Believing his words, I kind of encouraged him. 5 years later, he said he is going to get married. I didn't understand why 5 years earlier he said no marriage and 5 years later he said he is getting married. Obviously he had no idea that he is not a man who can withstand staying single. Another youngster approached Appa and told the same thing, that he is not interested in marriage and he is dedicating his life to service. that one of his service ambitions was to do service in his native town, so that every family in the town is covered with mother's books. Believing his words, Appa paid him a lot of attention. Gave him long, lengthy talks about service, sadhana, and how to come near mother, etc., like that. But suddenly one day he came up with a marriage invitation. And his book service schemes fell far short of what he claimed he would do. Then there was another devotee who came and told me that he was bringing up his son in such a way as to make him eligible for supramental transformation. Another lady wrote to me from Mettur Dam, seeking Appa's permissions to start a center of her own. Appa gave the blessings. She ran the center for 1 or 2 years. And then for 3 months there was no correspondence or email from her. Called to ask her why she has not sent any mails to me for the last 3 months. She told me my son became a drunkard and he died of cirrhosis of the liver. That she was so shattered by the death of her son that she lost her faith in mother and she wound up the center that she was running. It is the same lady who came to me begging for Appa's permission to start and run the center. On my recommendation, Appa gave the blessings, but when her son died because of cirrhosis of the liver, her faith in mother was broken and she wound up the center. So to me it's very obvious that people wanting to do service to mother or wanting to engage in sadhana need some accurate assessment of what is their own spiritual capacity in this direction. I find many people have exaggerated themselves way beyond measure. What capacity does a sadhak, does a disciple need to assess his capacity for service as well as sadhana in a measure that is true to his own personality, instead of allowing all kinds of exaggerations to come in between?
First, we must know. I follow the question.
Uh-huh.
Question is, what is the instrument we're using to assess our own capacity? When the vital has a wish, it calls that a reality. When it sees somebody else doing something and said, I would like to do that, it considers that a reality. Obviously, by definition, neither our vital preference is not going to give us an answer, and our mind under the reference to the vital or domination of the vital is not going to give us a realistic answer. Our thinking that what a person says is a reflection of the reality is like Darcy calls Lizzie tolerable. Lizzie tells Darcy, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. But she ends up married to him within a year. So you're talking about devotees, but you can talk about anybody. Lizzie says, any man that handsome must be good. So all your examples are only examples of the constitutional ignorance. Whether it's I should be a devotee, or I should be a king, or I should be a rich man, or I should be a movie star, or whatever else it is. It's not specific to devotees or spiritual matters. We are in the constitutional ignorance, and as long as we're on the surface, we cannot know anything with reliability. So if you're asking, how can the devotee know? Why the devotees, why you have these examples is simply because we take our thoughts or our preferences or our sensations as fact. That's what we all do all the time. These particular things have struck you because you believe you took what they said as the reality, the way Lizzie took Wickham's story as a reality, or Bingley when Darcy said you can't afford to marry Jane, Bingley took it for reality. Oh, I can't afford to marry her. Because Darcy thought he believed it at that time. But he was only acting out of vital preference. So these are only varied expressions of the fact that on the surface we don't know our potential. If you're asking how can we know our potential is one thing. I think you're asking how can you know other people's potential. First of all, you must be able to know your potential. First of all, we should not be on the surface in our own consciousness to know our own potential. When finding out and knowing somebody else's potential is a higher knowledge because we're caught and confined in ourselves. How can the person know their potential? Say, you know all the answers already. First thing, Appa says, for anything to be true, valid, to be accepted as valid, it should meet three criteria. First of all, it should be sanctioned by our own understanding as rational. Only when we're capable of being rational. Secondly, it should be true to our deepest feeling. We should feel with our deepest feeling that what I say or think is true. Not just that I wish it to be true or would like it to be true or hope that it's true or think it should be true. I feel in the depths of my being that it's true. Third, there should be an indication from life, a sanction from life. So I was just at the point when you raised this question of saying, how do we get from the surface to the subliminal? You all know the answers already. Appa says, practice silent will. Why? Why silent will? As long as I'm asking for what I want, I'm acting on the surface. I'm acting in the surface ignorance. For sure. When I practice silent will, I don't move from the surface to the depth. I stop insisting on the surface. When I stop insisting on the surface, if I don't ask, nobody will give. That's the typical rationale of the surface, no? If I don't ask, if I don't tell, nobody will know, everything will stay the same. That means we're on the surface. If I don't do it, it won't be done. I must move from the surface and refuse to act out of the surface. That enables the subliminal power to act. There, the one wonderful thing that Mrs. Bennett does is, her subliminal aspiration brings four grooms. She got three of them. She could have had all four of them if she hadn't spoiled everything. That's the act of the subliminal aspiration. The power. How does Mrs. Bennett have the power to marry four girls or even three girls in a year? Where does that power come from? It's not there in her mind. It's not there in her vital social personality. She chases everybody away. The moment she acts, everybody runs in the other direction. It's not her surface constitutional being that can get the girls married. It's her subliminal aspiration that brings the four of them there. all in a rapid period, brings them to the house, brings them to the girls, and creates that opportunity. What she does is she does the opposite of Life Divine. She goes, instead of going from the surface to the subliminal, she goes from the subliminal to the surface. Now that they've come, let me act. Let me spoil everything. Let me chase them all away. Let me abuse them and disabuse them. She does it wonderfully. In spite of that, three of them get married. It's a standing miracle. It shows how powerful the subliminal is. That's the truth. Whatever we evoke from the subliminal, we cancel out by our surface behavior, by activating our surface behavior. So silent will is a polite first step in saying, don't spoil things by acting out of our ignorance. If you keep quiet on the surface, there's a chance for something truer to come out. If you're not satisfied with chance, there's something you can do to help move from the surface to the subliminal. He calls it consecration. If every impulse you have to go out and tell other people what they should do or ask other people for what you want or take initiative, if every time you have an outer impulse, instead of that you catch yourself and say, Mother, thy will be done, not my will. You shift from the outer to the inner. Only thing is, we all know when we do that, we keep repeating that, after a while we're saying, my will, not thy will. And we have to catch ourselves. Even when we say thy will, what we really mean is, my will. We want your will to be our will. We want you to do what we want. As long as we want Mother to do what we want, and Mother to give us what we want, we're still on the surface. It's better that we pray to Mother for something rather than we try to get it ourselves. We hold back our surface personality. Say, if Mrs. Bennett had had the self-control to sit in the bedroom for 1 month and pray that Bingley marries Jane, Bingley would have definitely married her simply because she didn't spoil everything. It would have been a great progress for her if she could simply control herself. If she had really been able to say, Mother, whatever, I don't know, I'm a stupid lady, whatever you want, your will be done, you decide everything, all the five girls would have been married. But can she do that? Is she capable of doing that when there are four grooms walking around in Meryton? Is she capable of sitting there and really saying, Mother, your will be done? Even if she says it, can she mean it? No, it's Bingley. What she really means is, get Bingley to marry Jane. So consecration is not so easy. It's very difficult. Even silent will, we know it's not possible to keep silent. Even if we can keep silent, it's not possible not to react. How is it Bingley is dancing with Charlotte, that ugly girl? Darcy refuses to marry, to dance with Elizabeth. I hate him. To not react is not a great spiritual achievement. It simply means don't spoil the birthday cake by throwing sand on it. Don't chase away the suitors by putting our personality and ruining what Mother's trying to give us. Don't take handfuls of sand and put it in the sambar and make it unedible. Non-reaction means don't spoil what Mother's trying to give you. It's very difficult not to react. Yeah, it's very difficult for us not to spoil things. We're like Mrs. Bennett. We're like Mr. Bennett. We're like Darcy, who says she's tolerable. We're doing it all the time. So to move from the ignorant, constitutional ignorance to the depth means don't ask, don't react. Then Appa says there's something beyond non-reaction. He wrote a paper on it recently for you, Ashok. Non-action. Don't take action. How not to take action? We're breathing all the time. We're thinking all the time. What he means is, when we don't take an egoistic initiative in pursuit of what we want, when we don't insist on our capacities, we're moving from the surface to the depths. We're moving from the ego-selfish pursuits towards consecration. What's the real truth of non-action is, Mother, you act. I will not act, you act. I want you to act. I want your will to be done. What does it mean I want? There's something that should be done for your work, let it be done. Not for me, not for my benefit. I'm not thinking of myself. I want what you want. I want to happen what you want to happen, not just for me, but for everybody. And if you bring prosperity to others, I know that it's grace and prosperity for me. We know its theory is clear, but to move in our emotions from this attitude of I want what I want, what I want, and I'll ask for it, to really saying thy will be done is to move from the surface to the subliminal. And when we really, at the moment we're really able to consecrate, if we can consecrate even for a split second, at that point we reach the psychic. And it only takes a split second of reaching the psychic to change our lives, to change the whole life in future. And many devotees have had that and knows at an extreme moment of a moment of temporary sincerity when we have really shifted the attitude, and it was just honestly for a split second I felt grateful to Mother and she's changed my life. And we know how difficult it is to get back to that point again. So this is to move from the constitutional ignorance to the psychic, to discover the truth. We're not limited to our surface personality. We're not limited by any of the constraints that we see outside.
Gary?
Yes, Ashok.
I'm a little confused by what Appa says about the capacity of some of the spiritual prodigies of India. You read in Sri Aurobindo's writings that Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda are spiritual prodigies. But at the same time, I have heard from Appa that even Swami Vivekananda or Sri Ramakrishna are not even capable of passing the preliminary test in this integral yoga. When you read Sri Aurobindo saying that they are spiritual prodigies, and then you hear Appa saying that they won't even pass the preliminaries in this integral yoga, then you kind of get confused. Which is true?
It's not so confusing once you know the geography of our being. When you understand that most of us are locked in the basement of a 100-story skyscraper, and you find out that somebody's gone to the second or third floor, they are spiritual prodigies from our point of view. From the point of view of what Sri Aurobindo is offering to us, it's far from sufficient. When you understand the sevenfold ignorance that he's talking about, and we're only on the second of the seven, and we're not halfway through that, we're only in the second of the four rooms. When you understand the truth and you understand where they are, it's not to diminish their achievement. We can wish that we were all where they were and starting from there. We could be very proud of it, but we would know that's not enough. He says, why does he say that? He's not saying that to diminish the appreciation for Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, or anybody else. He's trying to break the superstition that their limited achievement is all that we're capable of or all that we should aspire for or all that the divine is seeking. That's what's necessary, because in India, the realization of the self, which is a high realization, and anything you read of Sri Aurobindo, he says, without this, no great spiritual achievement is possible. He says it. He acknowledges it. And they have done it. But it's only the first step. In synthesis, he says it's the first fundamental city. But it's not the last step. It's the minimum qualification. Unfortunately, in the tradition, it was taken to be the final goal and the final result. At this point, you retire. At this point, Sri Aurobindo says, yoga starts. At this point, the real potential begins. So there's no inconsistency there. It's only to know that what they achieved and took to be the whole is only a part. And that's what Sri Aurobindo says in the first chapter of Life Divine. The main problem with the tradition is only one thing, stopping in the middle. Don't stop in the middle. Don't stop until you reach the goal. And when we think the first step in the way is the goal, if I think getting rich or becoming famous or getting elected is the final realization possible in life, Siddharthi thought being master of Pemberley is all. There's nothing more for him after that. When he met Elizabeth, he discovered there's a whole universe, an emotional universe of affection and fulfillment that he never dreamed of before. So I don't think there's any inconsistency. It's only you have to know the perspective of Sri Aurobindo is very much greater, that's all. And the potentials of the human being are very, very much greater than their highest realization. Sri Aurobindo has great respect and admiration for what has been realized. But the problem is the society worships that as the ultimate. There, who can be beyond that? And Sri Aurobindo needs to say, anybody can go beyond that, because that's the truth of our being. They may be spiritual prodigies, but they're not doing something that human beings cannot do. They're doing something that many, many people will do in future and go way beyond it. And therefore, in appreciating it, we shouldn't mistake it for an unrealizable ideal. In 1966, when India was suffering from second severe year of drought, and the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, said that 10 million Indians may starve, Prime Minister Shastri asked Sisabramanyam to become the food minister at a time to avoid famine, do something. And CS went before the parliament, and he announced that his goal is within 5 years to make India food self-sufficient. Never import. It was importing millions and millions of tons of food every year. We were living hand to mouth here. And he got up before parliament and says, within 5 years I'm going to make India food self-sufficient, and they laughed at him. The parliamentarians laughed. The scientists said it's impossible. And he did it. Within 5 years, food production rose by 50%. It was the real first great achievement of independent India. And within 10 years, it doubled. How did he do that? How is it possible? By what miracle? C.S. is a farmer. He comes from a farming community. He understands the farmer's mentality. He knows his limitations. He says, if you can create a way for the farmer to produce more and prove to him he can earn more, he will work. He will produce. Nobody had faith in the farmer. What will those uneducated, illiterate, backward, primitive people do? We have a poor country. Nobody's qualified. Who's going to raise all this food? Obviously, if you ignore the farmer, nobody can raise the food. The politicians can't raise the food. The businesses won't raise the food. Only the farmer can raise the food. C.S. had the knowledge in the depths of his being. The farmer has this potential. If you guarantee him a market and you guarantee him a price, he will produce what the nation needs, and they doubled. It's a historical. In other words, he knew intuitively the subliminal potential of the Indian farmers, which wasn't there on the surface. No, these are backward. They're using old methods, old technology, primitive things, low yields. They're very backward. No. You can appeal to them, they'll bring forth their potential. The same that's true for the country was true, is true for everyone. When Churchill became the Prime Minister of England at the beginning of World War II, when all of Europe had been conquered by the German, the Nazis, and England alone remained free, and all the politicians in England had given up hope, and the Germans themselves thought within 3 months we'll defeat England and the whole of Europe will be conquered by Germany. That was what everybody believed. The Germans, everybody. They made Churchill Prime Minister because they didn't, nobody else had the courage to stand up and fight. And he got on the radio and they went into Parliament and he told the nation and he told the world, we will never surrender. We will fight on the air, we'll fight on the beaches, we'll fight on the sea, we'll fight on the roads, we'll fight in the fields, we'll fight in the cities, we will fight anywhere. We simply will never surrender. He didn't go and ask the people how many of you want to surrender and how many of you want to fight. He didn't consult anybody. He was receptive to Shervindo's force. He didn't speak from his surface calculations. According to my calculations, we can survive and defeat the Nazis. It wasn't a mental calculation. It wasn't based on his own capacities. It wasn't based on his own experience. Nobody's had this experience before. Something in him, faced with this tremendous crisis, went to the depths of his being. And he was receptive to Shrivindo's spiritual force. He felt the truth of it. He became an instrument of it. Because he didn't insist on being on the surface. Even though this man was an enemy of Indian freedom, he became an instrument for the freedom of humanity. He became Shrivindo's main instrument. And within less than 3 months, the Germans lost the battle for Britain, and they had to retreat. They thought in 3 months, everything will be over. In 3 months, they were defeated and had to retreat, and after that, it was all a turning point, going in the other direction. That's the power that's there in the subliminal. But if somebody calls Churchill to a meeting and says, how do you say we're going to win? How many pilots do we have? How many soldiers do we have? How many guns do we have? How many ships do we have? Prove to me what's the calculation and all. We've lost. Everybody's lost. You think we can win when the French have lost and everybody else has lost? So, well, who makes you think that way? What nonsense are you talking? No, you can't go by what other people. The experts say this. The military says that. The agricultural scientist in India said this is impossible. We cannot do this. Our farmers will never grow the hybrid varieties. The experts, so you have to have the good sense not to listen to the experts, not to listen to public opinion, not to listen to the opinion polls. You have to not listen to your own foolish imaginations and wishful thinking or fears and anxieties. In other words, we have to go away from the surface and go to the depths. Then the potential that's there in each one of us, in our subliminal being, can come to the surface. We say Mother does it. It's grace. Mother has done so much. That's true. That's very right for us. But Mother doesn't create something out of nothing. Mother has already created that subliminal potential in every one of us. It's there, but we insist on clinging to our surface capacities. In 1922, after World War I, the Czechoslovakian economy was collapsing. Unemployment rate was going up. The markets, overseas international markets, were collapsing. And the businessmen of Czechoslovakia called a meeting to demand of the government that they solve their problems. And all of the business people said, we can't do anything. The economy is ruined. Government must save us. And what can government do? How can any government save an economy? No country has that capacity to do that. And one man stood up and said, you're all asking government what it's going to do. I will tell you what I'm going to do. He was a shoemaker. Shoemaker with a few hundred employees. He said, I'm going to go back and I'm going to reduce the price of my shoes and I'm going to sell more shoes and I'm going to make my company more successful. And he went back and within 5 years his small company became the largest shoe company in the world, Bata Shoes. How did he do that? Where did he get that potential? That potential must have existed. Even in the middle of a Great Depression, even in a period when everybody thinks they're helpless, there's nothing they can do. He had that intuition of the potential. We can say he must have been a great man, but his potential is your potential, is our potential, because it's in our subliminal being. How big is our subliminal being? Our subliminal being is as big as the earth. The subliminal he's talking about is not a few times bigger than the physical body. It's universal. The limits to our capacity. How much knowledge can you get? You can get any knowledge that's there in the world now by the internet. Through the subliminal, you don't need the internet. You can get it because it's your being. Now when I say you can get it on the internet, you see it's reasonable because there are millions of computers and we can get what's on the computers. But your subliminal doesn't need a computer or an internet to get it. It directly is in touch with the knowledge of the world. If you want to fly from here to there or do things that seem miraculous 100 years ago, society has created that potential. But that potential is there in human beings. If you read the story of Around the World in 80 Days, Appa is a great admirer of that character, Phileas Fogg. Because when he says, I'm going to travel around the world in 80 days, and he does it actually in 79 days, they say, what about unexpected events? How will you, what about, you can't rely on things. What about weather? What about fog? What about breakdowns? What about military problems, security problems? So many things can go wrong that will prevent you from going, you know. And he said, no, I've taken all of that into account. How can you take all of that into account? Even between going from here to Saitapet, we don't know when the traffic will be blocked by a politician or by a crowd or a demonstration or by a flood or by something. How can you take that into account? He didn't take it into account with his mind, with his brain. He took it into account in his depths. He went into his depths and said, I can do this. I believe in this. He was aware of the fact, like Mrs. Bennett said, if I need men for my husbands for my daughters, I'll bring them. Let me not go searching around the marathon or searching around England. Let me go in and call. Let me go in. By my aspiration, I can bring them. Our aspiration comes from the depths and has the power to bring what we want. When I was much younger, when I graduated college, and I didn't know what I wanted, and I was searching for something, and I didn't know what I was searching for, and I spent 2 years reading books, foolishly thinking that by reading books I might find something. And for 2 years I was frustrated, I didn't find what I wanted. And then the book came to me. I didn't find the book. It was not by my effort. We each have that power in our subliminal to, called aspiration, which Appa writes so much about. Our aspiration brings forth the powers from our own subliminal being. This is our subliminal. We're totally ignorant of it. When Appa asks us to do something, we think, how can I do it? I'm a small person. I don't know anything. I don't have a degree. I don't have the money. I don't have the experience. I don't have the skill. I don't have the energy. I don't have the knowledge. Whatever it is. We give an inventory of our ignorance. That's all. And that's not all of our psychological being. The fourth room, it's not a room. We talk about rooms. If this is a room, this is our surface. Our subconscious is as big as Chennai. Our subliminal is as big as India. But the fourth room, he calls the superconscient. It's our room, it's our house, it's our being. And if, by that comparison, the superconscient is the whole earth or the whole universe. And he says our true being is there. Our true self. Our true self is not in room 1, 2, or 3. It's not here. It's not in Madras. It's not even in India. It's as great as the universe. It's beyond the universe, we really know. It is our superconscious self. It's the spirit. And only when we know that self, that eternal self, beyond time, beyond everything, it's not that that's all of us. All of this is us. It's not that this room and that room and this room are all nothing. All of this is us, part of a greater totality, which he's going to tell about when we get to the seventh ignorance. But we must know what we think of I and myself is only a tiny part. And if we want to find the whole, we have to stop thinking and acting as if I'm all alone and I'm here and so forth. So the psychological ignorance is we don't know who we are. We don't know what our being is. And the analogy that I like for that is that Darcy doesn't know who he is. Lizzie doesn't know who she is. Can Lizzie ever imagine that she's a character in one of Jane Austen's stories, and that the true self of Elizabeth Bennet is Jane Austen? No matter how much she looks and how many people she talks to and how many books she reads and how many courses she takes, can she ever awaken to the truth of her being? But the truth of the matter is we are characters in the story. If you wish, it can be Mother's story. Mother is the truth of our being. Mother is the author of our being. It's not that we relate to Mother. Mother is the truth of our being. She is really our being. And going to Mother, praying to Mother, loving Mother, seeking Mother is only going and seeking our true self. If Lizzie goes out and decides, I want to discover who Jane Austen is, what a progress she'll make. She has to realize that everything she knows about herself is only just a superficial. She has to go back from the mind of the character to the mind of the author who created her. Very difficult to imagine. But that's the progress, that's what's offered to us. That only then she would come out of her psychological ignorance. Only then we come out of our psychological ignorance. This is the second ignorance. We have to discover the self. How to do that? It comes to the third ignorance, which he calls the temporal ignorance. Temporal ignorance is, I think, and I think most of you think, that right now we're here at 12:38 in Mambalam, and this is where we are, and this is the only place we are. And the past doesn't exist anymore, and the future won't exist. And At best, I think, well, I've been around for 68 years, and by any stretch of the imagination, it's not likely to be another 68 years, because my life began at a particular point in time, and it's going to end at a particular point in time. And he says that's really ignorant. He doesn't say it's stupid, but from a spiritual point of view, it's really stupid for us to think that we started a few decades ago and everything ends in a few decades. It's a complete ignorance. It's a fiction. Our lives did not start with our birth, and our lives and our consciousness do not end when the body, when we leave the body and go on to something else. We've been doing this for a long time. And how long are we going to be doing it? Well, unless by some choice we decide to dissolve ourselves back into the absolute, you can be doing this forever. And presumably getting more, hopefully getting more conscious each time and getting better and better each time. Because it becomes more and more enjoyable the more conscious you get. And if in this life you have already discovered Mother and come to relate to Mother and feel Mother to some extent, what do you have to look forward to in future lives? When you know the truth, this much of the truth, there's so much more to discover. We're only in the first half an inch of a journey. But the temporal ignorance is we think we are confined in time and space when the truth is we are immortal beings. And there he challenged as a tradition, he says, even this idea that ultimately the soul goes back and dissolves itself in moksha is not true. It's not necessary. It's, the soul is eternal. The individual is eternal. It's not the body that's eternal. It's not my vital personality, thank God that that's eternal. It's not my mental ignorance that's eternal. It's my soul, which will go on and on and on. By why? Because it wants to go on. Nobody's compelling it because it chooses to go on. It's come here because it decided it wants experience, it wants to grow, it wants to discover knowledge and consciousness and delight of existence, and it's going to go on more. This is not the end of anything. There's no end unless you decide there must be an end. There's only adventure and challenge and joy and greater discovery and greater power as we come closer to Mother and closer to the truths of our own being. If Darcy reads the story and thinks, oh, my story ended with the marriage with Elizabeth, it's all over now, what would you say? Jane Austen only wrote about 1 year in your life. She didn't write about your childhood, and she didn't say what happens after your marriage. If she had ended the story saying you live happily ever after, she didn't just mean that you live happily for another 40 years with Lizzie and have lots of children and grandchildren. You will continue and continue in so many stories in the future. So unless we know our eternal being, unless we know that the truth of ourself is beyond space and time. That's in the superconscious self. That's the spirit. Only when you know that, that's why he says, this is the first fundamental city. Not the last goal. It's the last goal of Indian yoga. For him, it's the first step and qualification. Because why? Because only when you know the eternal self can you come out of the psychological ignorance and come out of the temporal ignorance. Because you realize you're really an immortal being. The immortality he's talking about in chapter 1 of Life Divine is not the immortality of the soul. You already have that. You don't have to earn it. It's a gift. It's the starting point. The immortality he's talking about is we can be immortal in the body. We can be immortal in life on earth. We can be immortal in the physical. That is what the destiny of the universe is for. That is what the supermental manifestation for. Immortality of the soul, you need not struggle for. It's already there. But the immortality of the soul is not the prize. It's the immortality of life, of a divine life, that is the prize that the divine has set out, then why we are all here and why we have come to Mother. And if we didn't have somewhere in the depths of our being some aspiration that goes beyond marriage and wealth and success, and if there wasn't something in us that aspired to know Mother in that way and to serve Mother in that way, we won't have come to Mother. Mother's not a charity handing out physical gifts. She's trying to awaken your soul for its destiny. And if your destiny is supramental being, divine life, that's really why we're here. That may not be what brought us here consciously, but that's really why she has brought us here, why she has chosen everyone. You know that line he has in Life Divine? He who has chosen the infinite has been chosen by the infinite. Maybe it's synthesis. We've been chosen by, you have been chosen by Mother to come this, not for food and clothes and car and house and all of these things and marriages and all of that that we are all thinking about. Because she has a mission for you. Your soul has a mission in coming here. And this is only a step in that process of that. So temporal ignorance, we have to shed it, at least even if we can't experience the reality of it in our mind. We have to stop thinking about, I'm running out of time for this and that, there's no time for anything. You have all the time in the universe. Just the point of view is not that anybody's short of time. The point is we're not using our time. We're not using our time for what it was given us. Our time was not given us to make money or anything else. Our time was given us to become close to Mother. We can do that right now. We can do that the next minute. Our time was given us to consecrate to Mother, to use every minute and every, oh no, I don't, I'm too busy, I have no time for, time for what? Every minute is a moment where we should remember Mother and come closer to her and become more conscious. And that takes us out of the temporal ignorance. We start moving out of the temporal ignorance the moment we know what's important is not what I do tomorrow, what's important is what I do this minute. Do I remember Mother? Do I consecrate to her? Do I move closer to her? Every time I consecrate to her, every time I remember her, I'm moving out of the temporal ignorance towards immortality. This is the third ignorance. The fourth ignorance is the egoistic ignorance. We're fairly familiar with it. It doesn't require lots of illustration. Chandrasekhar told me a wonderful story yesterday, which he's written for Appa, and I think all devotees will read the story. I'm not going to tell you the whole thing. It's a short story, but I'm going to tell you the essence. I hope he'll pardon me, because it was so inspiring, and the most inspiring thing is it's a true story. The short version of this story is the really short version of the story is a man from Madras, living in Hyderabad, wanted to marry his daughter, had no money to do it. He got a marriage offer from a wealthy family in Madras. This is 60 years ago. And he became very suspicious. Why is this rich man coming and offering to marry my daughter, his son to my daughter, without any dowry, without any expenditure or anything like that? There must be something wrong with it. And he said, well, it's a wonderful offer. Thank you very much. I'll think about it and write to you. And he thought about it for 2 months and found that he couldn't get any offer anywhere. And by the time he decided to accept that offer, the other boy was already pledged to some other family, and he missed that opportunity. And finally, after a great deal of struggle, they managed another alliance, not nearly as good in terms of money or family, but they managed an alliance. The problem was, by that time, all their money was gone. They were down. His property had been taken by people in Hyderabad who were fighting against joining India at the time of independence. He lost his property. He lost his job. He spent all of his money looking for a bridegroom. They were down to 600 rupees. How can you conduct a wedding with 600 rupees? Finally, out of desperation, they said, let's at least order clothes. They got the Saudi sales merchant, cloth merchant, to come to the house, young man, and show them all the clothes for a day, and they finally selected clothes for the wedding party, and the man said, cost is 1,200 rupees, I'll give it to you for 1,100 rupees. The wife said, we only have 600 rupees now, or I'll give you the rest after the marriage. The man understood they have a serious problem. He discussed with them, it's a long discussion, and finally he said, I have just started in my business, and I have saved 7,000 rupees for my business. I will give you 7,000 rupees to conduct the wedding of your daughter. You pay me back when you can. Immediately the girl's brother got suspicious. Who will offer like this? This man is just a cloth merchant. He doesn't even have a shop. He's coming here and promising us 7,000 rupees. Is it black money? Is it stolen money? Is it some kind of a scam? How is he going to cheat us? He becomes very alert and starts asking very sharp questions. The father of the bride begins to think, no, let me not spoil things again. He tells the boy, you shut up. Don't express this characteristic of the constitutional ignorance, which is suspicion and doubt, which can ruin anything and dissolve grace and turn it into a mud puddle. Just be quiet and get out of the way. This is the second time grace is coming to us. Let us not spoil it again. Let us accept it. Don't think. Just be quiet and accept. The boy went back and brought the 7,000 rupees, and they performed the marriage. And after they performed the marriage, Hyderabad became part of the Indian Union. The violence and everything in Hyderabad went down, and their property, which they had lost and took to be lost forever, was given back to them. They regained it. They sold it for 10,000 rupees and paid this man backed the loan plus something more. The story is not about the family with the girl who got married. The story is about the cloth merchant who lent them all the money he had and his whole capital in business. He went on to start a shop in Tinagar, which grew year by year, every year adding more buildings and stories to it, and is now a 500 crore company called Nelly Silks. This is the story of the egoistic ignorance. The man who thinks giving 7,000 rupees for somebody else is the most foolish thing, I'd lose everything I have, is in the egoistic ignorance. The person who knows that giving to others and serving others, he did it commercially through his company, who knows that others are himself and part of himself, comes out of the egoistic ignorance in that measure. And he goes from 7,000 to 500 crores because he expands into the truth of his own being. So, for us, we all know, as long as we're like Mrs. Bennett, oh, Bingley's dancing with Charlotte, that means I lose. My chain doesn't get. If somebody else gets married, it's a loss for me. Everybody's gain is our gain. It's a theme Appa's been drilling in so much. We know. That is the fourth ignorance, is we really think that we're all separate. The truth of the matter is, for anything to come to anybody, it should come to everybody. And most everything we have is what has not come to us. 99% of what we enjoy is what's come to everybody. If I say, I have internet and nobody else has it, there would be no internet. Internet is valuable only because everybody has it. We knew somebody who had cell phone and didn't want anybody else to have it. The only value of cell phone is everybody has one, so you can call anybody. What's the idea of saying, I have the only cell phone in the world? I have the only phone in the world. Then what can you do with it? You can only hold it up as a source of pride. Everything we enjoy, our knowledge, our language, our conveniences, the electricity, the air conditioning, the technology, the television, the entertainment, the clothes, everything we have because it's come to the world. Because it's come to everybody. And the more comes to everybody, the more will come to us. If we have freedom today, it's not because we're free. It's because India is free. It's because people all over the world are becoming free. So to come out of the egoistic ignorance is to know that everybody's gain is our gain, and the more we give to others, the more we get. That's the theme that Appa's been repeating. The fifth ignorance he calls the cosmic ignorance. If we know that we are not the surface little bubble, that we are not just confined to these four rooms, we are an immortal self. We are as big as the cosmos. We are as big as the whole cosmos. We see the cosmic being is our being. We're still ignorant. Because we are beyond the cosmos. When we come out of the temporal ignorance and the psychological ignorance, we discover we are the immortal being. We are the immortal self. So coming out of the limitations of a universe and saying in your address, I live in the universe. Oh, you want to limit yourself to a universe. Why? It's like Lizzie limiting herself to the story. The truth of Lizzie is she's Jane Austen. She's not limited to any story. She's not limited to any life. She's not limited to any character. She can live through, like Jane Austen, all the characters and all the stories and not be limited to any story. Because Jane Austen is there even when her stories, whether she writes stories or not. We come out of the cosmic ignorance and know the immortal self. But still, there are two more ignorances. The sixth ignorance is what he calls the original ignorance. And that is, that's the limitation that came from Ashok's question. When we think I'm being beyond the universe, and therefore I should go there, and my goal is moksha, we're still subject to a great ignorance, to the greatest ignorance, because the world is also our being. Because the absolute is not beyond the world. The absolute is everything, including the entire manifest universe. We are the omnipresent reality. We are not limited that we have to live in that room or this room or any room. All the rooms are ours. So the original ignorance is to know the truth of our being is it is all us. And finally, when we have come out of these six ignorances, then and only then, we come out of the seventh ignorance, which is the practical ignorance. If we should have the power to do everything perfectly, anything we want, anywhere, anytime, have mastery over anything, become anything we want to become, do anything we want to do, we have practical knowledge and power and delight in everything, that comes to us only after we have fully outgrown the other six ignorances. So most of us start at the other end and we say, let me get this perfect and then I'll worry about the other things. The other things are the solution to all our problems. No, I was too busy doing my work to think of mother. It's just the opposite. The more we think of mother, the more our work will be done. The more perfectly it will be done. No, I don't have any time for all these spiritual matters. I'm too busy trying to do my physical things and get them right. The truth is, only when we do them spiritually, they will all be done. Anybody like to share an experience or raise a question?
Sir?
Yes.
Sir, Ranjini had a question. I'm going to ask it on behalf of her. She asked, what is the equivalent of the subliminal in the involution?
What is the equivalent of the subliminal in the involution?
Yes, sir. Like Ananda is psychic, Sat is matter.
I missed that last part. I can answer the question, but I'm not sure what that like was.
Like Ananda is psychic and Sat is matter.
I see. In the involution, in the first stage of the involution, spirit becomes matter. Matter is subliminal. The subliminal includes the inconscient and the subconscient. All of the rest is subliminal to us. I was using the subliminal to refer to that space between the superconscient above and the subconscient below, which he also does. But the equivalent of the subliminal is everything is subliminal in the original inconscient until consciousness emerges in life. You can say, if you wish, that until the human, all the evolution is in the subliminal. It's inconscient and subconscient. He describes the subliminal as that space between the subconscient below and the superconscient above, which is conscious. It's not our consciousness on the surface, like I'm conscious or you're conscious now. It is a universal consciousness. We're not conscious there, but it's conscious. He says we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that consciousness is what we have. What we have is a little torchlight. Consciousness is like the sun. The whole universe has a plane that is not subconscious, it's not superconscious, it's universally conscious. And that's our being. That's the truth of our being. That's why if you go to the subliminal, you'll find you know what's going on all over the world. Not just physically. You can feel things, know knowledge from all over the world. You can feel what's in other people directly because you are that conscious in the depths. So I hope it's clear. In the evolution, everything is subconscious in the beginning. With the emergence of human consciousness, surface mental consciousness, the subliminal is that which is behind the surface, which we are not aware of, but which doesn't mean it's not conscious. It's conscious. We're not conscious of it. Darcy doesn't know that Elizabeth's at Pemberley, and Elizabeth doesn't know that Darcy's coming to Pemberley. But in the subliminal, Darcy knows that he's going to her, and Elizabeth is calling him. When he says, I want to be mistress of Pemberley. In the subliminal, they both have the knowledge. It's only in the surface that they're ignorant. Was there another question?
Sir, Ashokson has a question.
Okay, we'll take that and then go ahead.
Many good people are very ignorant of the crooked minds of the others.
Are very ignorant of?
Of the crooked ways in which other people's minds work.
Uh-huh.
So simply because they are good, they are not able to understand that others can be bad. Appa used to tell me that when he was a teacher in the school, he was not even aware that there are certain other teachers who are jealous of him and who are plotting his downfall. Simply because he had no capacity for ill will or jealousy towards others, he assumed that others were also like him.
Right.
So that led to a lot of trouble for his teaching profession. Now, how to remain good, but also at the same time be aware of the crooked ways in which other people's minds work. I don't find many people having that capacity to remain good, but also at the same time be aware of how the crooked mind of others work. They don't seem to have that capacity.
You know, there are people who have knowledge of the crookedness of other people, but they're not good. There are people who are very shrewd, who can see the falsehood in another person, but are not good themselves. Agreed? So there are two different functions. No? The crooked man who wants to overlook the goodness in another person, or the good man who wants to overlook the crookedness in another person, is allowing the ignorance of their nature. If we mistake, say, that's what Lizzie does. She sees that Wickham's handsome and he's charming and he's flattering to her, and therefore he must be good. What is she doing? She's imposing her vital preferences on her judgment of him and his character. So the good person wants everybody to be good and wants to be also, more importantly, in almost every case, the good person wants to be appreciated as a good person. The moment we want to be appreciated as a good person, we'll be subject to the illusions. So Lizzie really wants to believe that Wickham likes her, that he singled her out for attention because she's special. She really wants to be flattered and appreciated by Wickham, and therefore she likes him and calls him good. So first thing is, I'm giving my answer, I've not before thought about it. First thing is, the good person shouldn't be preoccupied by what other people think of them and proving their goodness to other people. Because the moment we want other people to think we're good, we'll be subject to the illusions of their behavior. Second, I hope that's clear. That's one point. Can I go on? I gave the example in a different context earlier today. As long as I want people to appreciate what I say, as long as I want people to appreciate what I say, I don't evaluate the person. I evaluate their response to me. When they say your presentation was marvelous, I think they're very intelligent. I call them intelligent because I think they think I'm intelligent, which is not a very intelligent thing to do. Because I want something from them in terms of recognition, I judge them by how they respond to me. So anybody who's willing to read, listen to me and think, oh, say he's very intelligent, I feel flattered by that. I said, this is a good person with good judgment. And when I talk to other people about them, I said, this is a very sensible man. Meaning, he thinks I'm sensible, and therefore I call him sensible. And that's really the way we are. That's really the way we judge. If the person doesn't like me, he's not a good person. If the person likes me, he's a good person. That's the vital. So if the person feels that I'm a good person, then I call him a good person. In other words, as long as we want something from other people or value the recognition and appreciation of other people, we cannot see them objectively, whether it's regard to goodness or intelligence or anything else. We have to not seek the approval of other people or the opinion of other people, but value them by what they are, not by their behavior towards us. But the truth is, it's almost the definition of a good person is somebody who's good to me. I learned a lot. I don't know when Appa told me that. It was a great insight. If you really want to know the goodness of other people, you should never judge it in terms of their relationship with you. You should see how they treat other people. And especially how they talk about other people when they're not there. It's common sense. What they tell you to your face, they're not going to... what they tell you about other people who are not there shows you their character. But when they come to me and they speak very nicely to me and appreciate me, it's a good person. He's a nice person. He would never do anything, speak anything wrong. Meaning, I don't think he'll speak wrong about me to my face. So we make that mistake of what's pleasing to us personally in our contact, or somebody who appreciates us, we want to judge them and value them on that basis. And we all do it because that's the vital. The definition of goodness to the vital is not an absoluteness of truth. It's how does that person behave towards me? He brings me gifts. He flatters me. He appreciates me. Therefore, he's good. So our definition of goodness is too much subjected to how a person relates to us. And then later when you find the person totally changes their behavior towards you, you're shocked. How is it possible he was capable of that? Because we have not understood the character of the person. We've only understood the behavior of the person, which is what Lizzie did. And Lizzie's an intelligent girl, and she's a good girl. She's not a bad girl. There's no mean streak in Lizzie. She may not be an ideal, but there's no mean streak or perversity in Lizzie at all, but she was capable of mistaking good behavior for good character and mistaking Darcy's bad behavior for bad character. He's not a bad character, but he happened to put up a bad behavior towards her, so she mistook it. So we can't afford to mistake behavior for character or judge people on how they relate to us personally. We have to see it impersonally, and that would make us more conscious of how our own mind and our own understanding is subject to our vital preferences. No, that person is not nice to me, therefore there must be something wrong with them, and I must find something wrong with them. That's what Lizzie does. When Darcy refuses to dance with her and calls her tolerable, she decides to find out what's wrong with him. And she finds out, sure enough, he's arrogant, selfish, and mean, and justifies it and tells everybody. But she totally missed the fact that he was capable of that magnificent, magnanimous gesture of saving Lydia and even paying Wickham. She never knew that capacity in him, because she was looking for that in him which justified her ill opinion of him, because he apparently had a bad opinion of her. So we've got to separate our judgment of other people from our field personal relations with the other person. The ultimate answer you're looking for is, you cannot judge the goodness of another person through your mind or your vital or the body. It's only the psychic that can judge the goodness of another person. For that, we have to detach from our personal preferences on the surface, our opinions on the surface, all of the surface, go within, and there the psychic can know, the psychic can sense. If we think we're going to rely on our mind to see good, it's like relying on your ears to see color or your eyes to hear sound. The mind doesn't have the faculty for seeing good any more than the eyes can see spirit. If you say, the spirit's in the room, I don't see it. Where is it? Goodness is not something that can be seen with the mind. Goodness is something that can be sensed with the psychic. Okay?
Ignorance, seven ignorances, Gary sir. Explain, Penny sir, from the experiences and pride and prejudice are explained பண்ணி சொன்னது. இக்னரன்ஸ எப்படி ஷெட் பண்ணணும், எப்படி ஷெட் பண்ணினா நம்மளுக்கு வந்து அந்த சப்லிமினல டச் பண்ணி நம்மளோட பீயிங் அந்த அளவுக்கு எக்ஸ்பேண்ட் ஆக முடியுங்கிறத எக்ஸ்பிளைன்ட் வெரி வெல். ஐ எம் க்ளோசிங் தி செஷன் அண்ட் தேங்கிங் எவ்ரிபடி அண்ட் ஸ்பெஷலி ஐ எம் தேங்கிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி அண்ட் ஹி டெலிவர்ட் தி ஸ்பீச் ஹியர் தி அட்மாஸ்பியர் ஹஸ் பீன் so much raised and thank you very much.